This podcast is supported by The Real Real.
You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
So while we wait for one more panelist, I'm just going to start the introduction. They'll be coming in within probably the next few minutes. So, hello, good afternoon. This is perhaps space or foamic space we've ever done before, because this is the most important one, everyone's saying. It has often been said that the Fed hikes things until things break. And last week, we've had numerous bank collapses. Yet, inflation has remained sticky, and the economy has reported better than expected job numbers. And so we're kind of left here waiting for Powell's words. So I want to welcome everyone for joining and say hi. I'm Unusual Wales. We have the literal macro greats here on Twitter to discuss, and I'm happy to have Nicholas help lead the conversation. Thanks, everyone, for joining. And Nicholas, if you can. While Nicholas does that, I'll just I'll quickly kind of start with the intros. I'll start with Joseph Wang. There's perhaps no better person in the world to walk us through what happened over last week. We want to welcome Joseph Wang, our go-to Fed guy. He headed trading at the Fed's open desk, has an incredible book called Central Banking 101. He's the CIO at Monetary Macro. And he just released a bunch of great macro courses. So, hey, Joseph, how's it going?
Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here. This is absolute best spaces. And so if you guys have been following the spaces for the past few months, we here have kept you on the right course. We've been spot on about the Fed pivot towards pushing out rate hikes into it. And now I'm really excited to hear what everyone thinks the Fed will do. As Unusual Wells noted, we're kind of at an interesting point here where we have competing concerns of both inflation and perhaps financial stability.
Precisely. I think Nicholas is back, so I'll let you take over, Nicholas.
How's it going, everybody? Who have we introduced so far? Sorry, I came in late here. I have someone at my door. Alrighty, so we'll move right along the line. Looks like we got a nice intro for Joseph. Up next, we've got Jem Karsant, a leading volatility expert, the founder of Kai Volatility, which you should be subscribed to, an incredibly passionate educator in the options vol and flow space, and a regular on the UW spaces. Welcome, Jem.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. As always, big Fed meeting here. I think much bigger than we've experienced for quite some time. I think there's a whole range of potential outcomes, particularly in terms of what the Fed is going to have to say and do here on the heels of this banking mess. Looking forward to chatting today. Kai Volatility, if anybody's interested, wants more information from us, go to kaivolatility.com. You can subscribe to kind of our news, /news. Reach out.
Absolutely. It's a must. So please do subscribe to it. Our next speaker is Randy Woodward. He's a bond investor for 30 years, was working at Bloomberg from 1988 to 1995. This is his fourth time on our spaces, and he's a great thing for all things macro. Welcome, Randy. How's it going?
Hey, great. Thanks for having me. I worked at Bloomberg for about 7 years. And with those skills, basically what I did is I sold Bloombergs with bonds, and I just turned it around, and I've been selling bonds with Bloombergs ever since. I've been selling them primarily, almost exclusively, to banks and credit unions since 1995. So my optics of bank portfolios is probably more intense than most. And a lot of what I've been seeing on, you know, Twitter and media, and I hate to mention Jim Cramer, but people like that, that are just saying absolutely ridiculous things about bank portfolios and the difference between HTM and AFS and all sorts of other things they don't know about. So my motivation to be here is to, you know, to bring some clarity to what community banking really is and what they were dealt in 20 and 21, and then what they were dealt by the very quick Fed rate hikes. To me, a lot of the problems you're seeing is something that they absolutely could not avoid. And it is very much the Fed's doing. And I think this new BTFP program, in my opinion, is to give the Fed a little more time to leave rates where they're at. But I think cuts are coming soon. There you go.
Perfect. We'll talk about all that shortly, not the Jim Cramer stuff, though. But our next speaker is far better than Jim Cramer, Michael Cao. He's the Chief Investment Officer and Portfolio Manager of Cao Family Office, having worked previously at Akathanos Capital Management. He's an expert in commodities, index arbitrage, and dynamic hedging, and is actually incredibly funny on Twitter as well. Welcome, Michael. I believe, Michael, you might be muted or having speaker problems. Oh, there we are.
Sorry about that. Always honored to be here. Thank you very much. I'll help you out a little bit with the pronunciation. It's Akathanos Capital. That was my firm for 17 years that I ran after I spun out of Canyon in 2002. So now you can consider me a semi-retired hedge fund manager who's just very passionate about the markets, and I just invest. Somebody called me. I had to turn that off. Can you guys hear me?
Yep, can still hear you.
Okay, sorry. All right, so real quick, I guess I'm going to disagree with Randy right off the bat about what I think the Fed's trajectory is going to be. I think that in some ways it's a little bit silly to talk about whether it's going to be zero or 25, just like, you know, in past FOMC spaces, wondering whether it's going to be, you know, 50 or 75. I've said in the past, I think it's kind of like analyzing the tread depth of a bulldozer bearing down on your head. I think that the Fed's mission, the Fed's trade-off between its dual mandate is not here yet. And despite the numerous admonitions for the Fed to stop, I think the bigger picture here is that the BTFP facility is basically a surgical ring-fenced action. I sent out some anecdotes yesterday about how, you know, last week I was invited to a number of private chat groups with a ton of depositor angst and, you know, gazillion messages per second. And this week, all those groups have disappeared. And I'm not saying that there won't be continued stress in the financial markets, but here's the thing. That's kind of what the Fed has been aiming for over the last 15 months, right? You know, when you look at where we are at in the macro picture, we've got, you know, 3% GDP growth, still 3.5% unemployment. Nothing has broken yet. And inflation is the biggest regressive, is the most regressive tax of all that that impacts 100% of people. So I'll just save that piece for now, and then we'll talk about it later. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. So last but not least on our docket, and then I do want to come back to some of those talking points here from a little earlier on. But first, we've got Bob Elliott. Bob's the CIO at Unlimited Fund, former IC at Bridgewater, and the all-time leader in useful tweet threads during a banking crisis. He's a friend of these spaces. Let's give Bob a warm welcome. How are you doing, Bob?
Hey, how's it going? I appreciate that. It was a busy couple weeks around here for sure. Thank you for having me. This is, you know, always such a great space and such a jam-packed lineup here of insights. So really happy to throw my two cents in here and offer whatever thoughts I have.
Thank you much. Always a treat to have you here, Bob. Thank you. So I'm going to go right into this. We had some good discussion there, especially with what Michael was saying a moment ago. So let's get into what Randy and Michael were saying. Randy, you had said that what occurred with the banks was unavoidable. Can you let us understand what's going on and why regional banks and their risk were not to be blamed?
Okay, I'll try to do it really quickly. Just interrupt if I get too long-winded. So you have basically March 2020. We have rate, you know, the Fed starts to hammer rates lower. And more importantly, they start buying trillions of mortgages. And so that's crushing mortgage spreads. Now, personally, I still don't know who was in trouble. I don't know who they were saving by entering the market. So just as a rough estimate, let's just say, and we're talking about 30-year collateral, which again, by the way, most banks did not buy 30-year collateral. That's one of those things out in the market that everybody keeps saying, oh, they bought assets for too long, and it's simply not the case. But using that as a proxy, you've got a certain coupon, probably around 2% 30-year mortgage-backed securities, getting to about par. And so my clients are buying hand over fist as much as they can, fast as they can. And that's including 15-year, 20-year, whatnot. Then all of a sudden, the Fed jumps in. And within days, it's not par anymore. It's 105. Now, okay, so we got a big serious problem here, because this is something I don't think anybody would have seen unless you're kind of in my little world, which is very small and opaque. Banks, you know, any collateral you owned at a premium going into this situation, well, now you're getting crushed on that, because if you owned it at even 102 and a half, and imagine 103, 4, 5, banks that own, and again, any type of maturity on that, well, everything's refined now. You know, they crush mortgage rates around the country. And I think at least 70% of all mortgages in the United States refi during this.
You've finally broken loose from work. Three friends, one tea time, and then the text. Honey, there's water in the basement. Not exactly how you pictured your Saturday. That's when you call us, Cincinnati Insurance. We always answer the call, because real protection means showing up, even when things are in the rough. Cincinnati Insurance. Let us make your bad day better. Find an agent at CINFIN.com.
2 year period of time. So as this is happening, they're taking negative yields on some of what they own. They're literally going negative yield. They're losing money on what these modest premiums they bought. So what's that mean? On anything they got to buy new, they don't want to pay 102 and a half, 103, 4, 5, whatever. So they got to try to get near par. Well, that takes us down even lower into the 1.5% kind of coupon collateral. Well, now, and also remember, we heard lower for longer for a really, really long time. And we heard somebody reminded me on Twitter earlier, we're not even thinking about raising rates. So we're in an environment where we have to assume this is going to last for a very long time. And there's only, and by the way, we still got to get some net interest margin. So all of this is going on. Then the Fed and probably more so the government puts in a trillion or so more new deposits into the system. Some of my banks double in size. They have to do something with those new deposits. They're either going to lend them out or they're going to put them with me, which was good for me for a couple of years. And we do the best we can to add, you know, we got to take some duration. We try to do it with cash flow. And so that would heal with, okay, if we create a portfolio with cash flow, we will heal with time. But now we had the Fed, complete reversal, maybe necessarily. And this is what every single bank in the United States is dealing with. It's not just the bond portfolio, it's also the loan portfolio. And things are breaking, and the more breaking is coming. There you go.
Thank you, Randy. So kind of as we plug along here, per usual, I'd like to keep things open and fluid. So if anybody has anything to add while someone else is talking, please use that good old-fashioned Twitter hand emoji and chime in. So, Joseph, I'm actually going to come over to you next here. I saw that you unmuted as well. Randy spoke about the bank's balance sheets and negative yields due to the interest rate hikes. So, Joseph, do you agree with Randy or Michael here regarding the bank's responsibilities or the Fed's here?
So I think Randy makes some really good points about the asset side of the bank's balance sheet. No doubt that if you're a bank, you have a lot of loans, you have a lot of securities. Some of them are fixed rate. And so when interest rates go higher, they decrease in market value. But I think we also have to look at the liability side of a bank. So a bank has basically, as we all know, they borrow short and lend long. They have a lot of deposit liabilities. And deposit liabilities can be withdrawn at any time. So what a bank is always afraid of is everyone comes and asks for their money back at the same time. When that happens, you know, a bank might not have enough cash on hand and a bank gets into a lot of problems. So this is a very basic problem for any bank. And there are many ways to manage this. A very common way, for example, would be to issue lots of CDs. If you issue CDs, then the depositor can't withdraw their money until the CD is expired. So 3-6 months. So boom, you help manage your liabilities. But for a bank like Silicon Valley Bank and many of the regional banks that we talk about, the more basic way to manage this is to have a diversified deposit base across industries and across retail as well. The reason for this is that if there's a banking panic, then if you are a retail depositor, your deposits are protected by FDIC insurance up to $250,000. So for a bank to want to avoid having a panic, you want to have a deposit base that's largely insured deposits. This way, depositors don't panic and you don't have this kind of run that you see in Silicon Valley Bank. Or at the very least, you have a business book that's diversified across industries. So if you have a single industry that's taking a hit, you don't go bust. When I look at Silicon Valley Bank, for example, I'll note that about over 90% of their deposits are uninsured. That's extremely uncommon and extremely irresponsible for a bank. So typically, a bank of Silicon Valley's size has about 50 to 60% of their deposits insured. So about maybe 40 to 50% will be uninsured. So Silicon Valley Bank was basically doing a really poor job managing their liabilities. And I would also note that the banks that we see have trouble now, Silicon Valley Bank and First Republic, both kind of did this. Now, First Republic, not as bad as Silicon Valley Bank, which was an extreme outlier across the banking sector. So I think of what happened, not so much as the Fed's fault, but as in a few banks that, to be honest, most of us have never heard of having some problems. And also note that these banks, Signature, First Republic, Silicon Valley, they're heavily exposed to industries that were not doing well. Venture capital, crypto, stuff like that. So we have 4,000 banks. The banks are businesses. Some of them are badly run and some of them go bust. I see this as much more micro than macro. Of course, what the Fed did not help. So I think that this is not a really a major regional crisis. Major, so it's a crisis in some parts of the banking sector, but not a systemic problem. So I lean towards what Michael is saying. And so that is, okay. And when you're talking about monetary policy more broadly though, I think it's important to separate what's happening in the real economy and what's happening in the financial economy. So right now, some people are looking at what's happening in this, which I believe to be more of a regional problem, and thinking that this Fed is going to cut rates and so forth and so forth. that's a huge problem for the Fed, because there are many parts of the economy that are doing fine. And when the markets begin to believe that the Fed is going to be cutting rates in the future, then you have the potential that, let's say, mortgage rates go lower, housing reaccelerates, many other parts of the economy face lower borrowing rates and they accelerate as well. So I think it's a challenging place to be for the Fed.
Thank you, Joseph. Michael, I see your hand up there, and then I've got a question to kick over to Bob. So, Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to riff a little bit on what Joseph said about the fundamental problem, which at the center of all financial crises, which is asset liability mismatch. And of course, you know, it's always most acute in banking, first and foremost, because of the short term nature of the liability side of the balance sheet. But I agree with Joseph that, you know, I think this is a pretty idiosyncratic situation to begin with. And then if you then lump in the BTFP facility and the fact that the discount window has been open, these are, as Joseph has so eloquently put it, this is liquidity. These are liquidity tools provided at a restrictive price. So the bigger picture, I agree with, is still going to be a tightening bias to rein in the inflation genie. But I do want to say that to extend this asset liability mismatch issue, I think we might all be focused on the last war, which is GFC. And I really don't think this time the crisis is going to be in the banking sector. I think it's more likely to be in somewhere in the shadow banking sector, where it's much less regulated. And my definition of shadow banking is all financial intermediaries, right? So in the world of hedge funds, venture capital, private equity, endowments. And so obvious. So coming from the hedge fund industry, I can just say that, look, in 2006, I myself experienced, sorry, 2007, I should say, I experienced some of this, because, you know, I had a very large LP that was exposed to the Amerant blow up in 2006. And they, unbeknownst to me and other managers they were investing with, had promised their LPs 30-day liquidity when they were invested in quarterly and annual liquidity managers. So when they started getting redemptions because of Amerant that blew up in 2006, in 2007, they wound up having a major asset liability mismatch, and they had to put their entire $4.5 billion fund of funds into liquidation and essentially redeem from all investors. So I was on the other end of this, which was very, very harrowing, because it also careened into the events of 2008 for me. So that's an example of how an asset liability mismatch can blow up in the hedge fund space. And of course, in 1998, we saw a spectacular blow up in LTCM, right? But it can also happen in longer lived vehicles like venture capital and private equity, because one of the fallouts that I foresee from this Silicon Valley bank failure is that, you know, despite the ring fencing and protection of the depositors, credit to that sector is going to be very, very tight now. And so you're going to have a bunch of VCs that are going to be thinking, shit, you know, a bunch of my startups are not going to survive unless I provide follow-on capital. What does that mean? They're going to start issuing capital calls, and then the capital calls invariably come to LPs and endowment funds and pension funds and teacher retirement funds at a time when they're probably getting their asses kicked elsewhere in the markets. So to me, that's those hidden icebergs are what I am looking for. And so then the question is whether or not it's going to be a too big to fail type of situation like LTCM was. And right now, despite a couple of hedge fund blowups last week, that's just not the case. So I just don't, until unemployment meaningfully ticks up, I don't think the trade-off between the Fed's inflation fight versus price stability is here. It's just not here yet.
Thank you. So now real quick, Randy, I do see your hand, but I want to kick over to Bob here first, then Jem, and then I'll come back to you, Randy, to get your comments on everything that's been said. So first here, Bob, was there an asset liability mismatch, or should the Fed take more responsibility? For reference, looking at FRC, Pan W, and other regional banks, they saw huge withdrawals last week.
Well, I think... The basic question, if we go back to where we were 15 years ago, when I was a young lad focused on figuring out whether the financial crisis was going to be a big deal or not, what the problem there was that there was a bunch of crappy loans and securities holdings by extraordinarily highly levered banks. And it wiped them out in some cases multiple times over. And so we spent 15 years trying to figure out a way to make these banks, the risk of a bank failure, go down a lot. And look, big picture, a lot of progress has been made. The amount of capital that exists in most of these banks is significantly higher than it was before. The amount of liquidity that these banks are holding against their short-term liabilities is much higher today than it was before. But there has to be, you have to have some asset to put that capital into those, to create that liquidity. And there was a lot of incentives to hold, you know, treasuries and agency MBS, because those are the things that were yielding, but also low capital risk and liquid. And so, you know, what we saw was an outcome of the regulatory regime combined with, frankly, a bit of imprudence, you know, while we all said that rate, you know, while the Fed and others said rates were going to be low for a long time, it's not like, you know, anyone who was holding these securities should have recognized that there was duration risk, and many of the sophisticated institutions did and do and hedge their exposure as a function of that. And so now we're getting to a problem that is mostly concentrated in, you know, smaller institutions that have operated either more in a riskier way or in a way that is in a way that's imprudent. And, you know, those institutions incentivized by the Fed's by the regulatory framework, hit by the Fed's behavior raising interest rates in the overall late cycle inflationary environment. Yeah, a couple of them, you know, are made some bad choices and are paying for it. I think the real question is how do we, you know, but big picture, like I put something out yesterday, like the order of magnitude we're talking about here is like 1/10 of what the financial crisis was, even in the most extreme scenario, and on this duration exposure. And if the Fed provides enough liquidity so these bonds can be held to maturity, they're by and large, they pay exactly what, you know, not by and large, they do pay what they were intended to pay, what the yield was when they were bought. And so maybe there's some NIM compression. It's not that bad. So big picture here, like take it from a guy who was in the middle of the banking crisis 15 years ago. This ain't nothing. It's annoying. We need to adjust the regulations. We need to figure out how not to get banks into this position. But at a big picture level, it's not that big a deal. And you can see that functionally in what's going on with asset markets, in particular when you look at stock markets, credit markets, et cetera, all of those markets. Like stocks are up in this crisis, right? Stocks are up through this crisis. It's what crisis? I keep calling this a crisis in quotation marks for a reason, because it's not that big a deal with the context of the overall macroeconomic scenario and the context of what a real banking crisis looks like. This is nothing.
Thank you, Bob. So I'm going to spin. I loved it. It's a lot of really good talking points that I'm sure we'll get some feedback from the rest of the panelists here after my question to Jem here. So Jem, before we dive deeper into comments on what's been said so far, and Randy, we'll get to you right after this question as well. So Jem, who is responsible for the problem? And in better terms, who's responsible for the fallout and solution going forward? You'd mentioned two things. One was on the miscommunication by the Fed regarding regular failure. And the second, on TD Ameritrade, you said that it's frustrating for the Fed. You said they want to pause because there's not clarity. And you think that Powell is going to speak to get the long end of the curve and the Fed is still selling calls, so to speak. Could you explain that a little bit for the folks listening, Jim?
Yeah, absolutely. So look, we were very clear that come mid-February that all of, you know, some of the structural flows that have been kind of pushing up the market were going to meet kind of their natural end, which is, you know, the Fed's constant having to push against this wealth effect that's been going on, right? This this 20% rally off the bottom that we got starting in October, November last year. The Fed has been vocally trying to get the long end of the curve higher, the market lower. They want yields up at the long end of the curve, and they want equity markets down. And everything they've been doing has been pushing up against that until, and they got what they wanted at first. Markets came down here, right in this window. Now, unintended consequences, right? You know, led to kind of this you know, call it a bank run, call whatever you want to call it here. My opinion is that the bigger picture, this is exactly like this rally back in equities that they've now gotten as a function of them selling way out of the money puts, or you know backstopping these banks, call it, is not what they want. They don't want this positive wealth effect. They don't want the speculation back in the market here, and they definitely don't want you know, long yields down again. We just last just several days ago last week got a really hot housing starts multi-family, you know, starts, you know, there's a little bit of a lag, but, you know, we're up 24% year over year. You don't want lower mortgage rates stimulating, you know, going into the spring here, housing, if you've been battling a hot CPI and battling, sticky employment. So I think this is a very interesting Fed meeting. I think a lot of people are getting out over their skis with the Fed, like, going to have to reverse course or, pivot. They're going to come back in and try and do what they've been doing. They've been pretty clear that they still see the inflationary battle as front and center. That said, I think they were hoping for this being an opportunity if they could bring down asset values to pause and look around. They want markets lower. They keep getting pushed back into the fray because they have to, and I have to be back in. So I do think the Fed is going to continue to, quote unquote, sell calls, not actually sell calls. This is, metaphorical in the sense that they really want to put a top on this market, make sure that, the speculation in particular is being taken out of the market. And they will continue to do that because they have to. Otherwise, structural inflation is still very sticky. And it's a function of the wealth effect and all this speculation. So I think that's something to look for here. I think that's the bigger story. I think markets have really, markets are basically where they were when this all started, quick round trip, yet yields are significantly lower. And that is not what the Fed wants at all. They wanted to kind of backstop these banks, but they want equity markets lower. So I think that's something to be very, don't fight the Fed. I think that, take them at their word on terms of, where they were last Fed meeting and what they've said since, just because they had to backstop some of this and ultimately, provide liquidity into what is always a tail in banks. That is not the bigger picture here. So I would be very cognizant of that going into this numbers here. I think that's the biggest takeaway, for today. They may be selling way out of the money puts and making sure that the market doesn't get some massive liquidation. That's always their role. They're always going to be there, but that doesn't necessarily mean buy equities. Actually, if anything, if you see the adjustment, they're going to want to push back against that, which I think is very important.
Thank you, Jim. So that was a lot of comments and feedback regarding the original points, kind of around responsibility and balance sheets. So Randy, thank you for being patient thus far. I'd love to hear your full thoughts addressing what's been said so far. And I'm going to leave this topic open to the panel here. So everyone, while Randy's given his 2 cents here, please feel free to raise your hand and we'll get you in that queue to chime in.
Yeah, I agree with everything everybody's saying, and I absolutely agree. This is not 2008, and I think, you know, most banks are very, very strong. I think the thing that, you know, this BTFP program is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, I've never even, you guys may have, I've never even read about anything like this, where we're going to lend at par. I know your collateral's worth 70, 80 cents, 90 cents, but we'll lend you full par. I've never known that to be done. By the way, also, here's our rate today. It's going to be lower than anything else you can borrow from home loan bank, discount window, CDs, current deposit rates, you know, if you're going to be competitive, you know. So please use this. And also, if the rate is lower tomorrow, go ahead and we'll roll it into the new rate. We'll continue to do that for as long as you want. So to me, it says two things. We know what we did. We know what we've put you through. We know that we repriced most of your assets at the lowest yields in history in 2021. And we know we just crushed all your assets valuations with 450 or so more basis point hikes. So, you know, and to me, like I said earlier, I think they're just trying to buy time. I think that's where we all just, where I disagree with everybody the most, is just that I can see what's coming for these banks. And look, man, we need them. They're the community. They finance the economy. We need them. And, you know, even though my assets are going to reprice, they're going to reprice pretty slow because duration's extended. Okay. That's the bonds that I sold to these banks. It's different on their loan portfolios, particularly CRE, commercial real estate. Those are done in about 5 to 10 year fixed, you know, between 5 and 10 year fixed rate. They're coming. There was a Bloomberg article just recently. There's like, you know, 900 billion or whatever getting ready to reprice this year or next year. Now, that can be extended. See, this is going to be the new sort of phase we're entering here, is that these banks have the ability to, you know, guy comes in and says, look, I cannot afford to refinance this property from 4.5% to 6.5%. I can't cover the debt coverage given the cash flow out of that property. And by the way, that's way worse for offices. Okay. One of the guys in my firm that have eyes on this saying, look, it's probably 10% for the office. So that's coming. And so what these guys, the banks can do, is they can extend 6 to 12 months. But then regulators come in and say, okay, you got to stop doing that. You can't do that anymore. You got to, this thing has to mature. You got to refi it. There has to be a process. Then it comes down to, all right, do I get the keys, or, you know, do we find somebody to buy the property? You know, it's, those complications are coming. And that's personally, that's what I think is going to, I think that's what's going to motivate the Fed to, they got to soften this at some point.
Thank you, Randy. Michael and Bob, I see your hands up. Let's go Michael first, then we'll kick over to Bob.
Well, I think where I fundamentally disagree with Randy is what is the Fed trying to accomplish big picture-wise? Because if the goal, I mean, if you take the Fed at its word for in terms of its mission over the last 15 months, you can almost think of it as a single mandate Fed right now, right? It is to get that inflation genie back into the box. Now, I agree that monetary policy is a blunt tool to do it, but it's the only tool they got. And so how do they do that? They need to lower the aggregate demand curve for everything. And how do you do that? You need to create a slowdown in the economy and make unemployment go up. Well, 3.6%. The Fed has hinted many times that they would probably be okay with a full percentage increase in the unemployment rate. But so this is where I think people need to realize that that is not a loss of 20,000 jobs or 200,000 jobs. That's a loss of 1.5 million to 2 million jobs. From that perspective, there is a lot of wood to chop, you know, if that is really sort of a goal. And so, I don't want to sound callous about it, but this is where the earlier point that I made about inflation being the regressive tax that that impacts 100% of the people. Well, the Fed has to think about the other 338 million people in the population. Yes, it's going to really suck for an additional 2 million unemployed, but the cost of living is very, very high. And we have not seen a structural inflation issue like this in decades. So I think that is where sort of this, you know, this is different this time. And it's sobering. I've been saying this for the last year and a half on Twitter, basically, saying that, look, because we've had decades and decades of liquidity lottery, we've all forgotten what's enabled that liquidity lottery to paper over every single financial crisis since the 90s. It's the lack of structural inflation. If you look at core PCE since the early 90s until now, it's been basically well behaved within like the 2 to 2.5% range. But this time, it is really out of bounds and offsides. So that really, really limits the Fed's degrees of freedom. And frankly, again, back to all the points earlier, the trade-off is simply not here yet. I'll say that the trade-off will be here if unemployment's at 4.5%, then there's a real trade-off, but the trade-off's not here.
Thank you, Michael. Bob, anything to add there? And then Randy, I'll have you chime in after. I saw you unmuted there.
Well, I think it's important when you're thinking about banks and the challenges that banks face to understand how these cycles play out over time, which is the big risk to a bank is immediate risk of being forced to remark their asset book, which then causes equity holders and other people in the capital stack and, you know, risking depositors, creates risk that the bank is going to go broke and they're going to incur losses. And that's the core risk. And that's essentially what we saw with Silicon Valley Bank, right? Which is securities that were remarked that created losses that caused concern about, you know, the viability of the bank and then created a bank run. I think it's very different when we start to talk about other elements of the balance sheet that frankly take a really long time to play out. So, you know, a lot of people today, and the reason why I wanted to talk about this for just a moment are highlighting commercial real estate's going to be a risk. Absolutely. Commercial real estate will be a risk. Right now, the charge-offs on commercial real estate for small banks in the fourth quarter of 2022 was 2 basis points, right? I just want to, like, think about that. 2 basis points was the charge-off rate, the annualized charge-off rate, which is essentially zero. And the reality is the banks, when it comes to the loan books, have a lot of time for these dynamics to play out, both in terms of the fact that they are earning some NIM on those assets, which help offset losses so they can remain profitable. But then also when those loans come due, they have the ability to restructure that debt, extend it, et cetera. And so first of all, we're nowhere close to that being an issue. When over the course of the next 3 to 5 years, we get to a point where those sorts of loans are an issue, we're likely to see regulatory relief that allows for the restructuring of that debt to push it out further and further. And that's really how bank regulators through all time have handled credit problems that are non-immediate for the banking system. That's how you prudently handle it so you don't ruin the overall banking system. We're likely to see the same thing. And so really all we're concerned about right now are these securities that are getting booked fast. And we have a great backstop for that in place so that, you know, they don't have to take the losses immediately. You put that all together, and sure, small banks may not be leveraging up their balance sheet fast here over the course of the next year, but there will not be a crisis in small banks anytime soon.
I want to follow up a little bit on the real estate side. So there's this really good Odd Lots episode this past week on commercial real estate, and a couple of really good points that stood out to me was that commercial real estate is it's a asset that's comprised of many different subcategories, each with their own different fundamentals. We have things like office space, which are not doing well because, as we know, many people are working from home. But you also have things like, say, multifamily rentals or industrials that are doing fine. So when you're thinking about commercial real estate as an asset class, it may be more that you have these office spaces that are not doing well, but those are actually the outlier. And another point that I thought was really good was that, so you make these loans, say, 5-10 years ago, and now they have to reprice. But over the past few years, property values have increased significantly. So let's say 5 years ago, somebody bought $100 in property, $50 in equity, $50 in loans from a bank. Well, today maybe that property is worth $130, $150. So from a lender's perspective, a bank lender, there's a lot more equity in that property. And so, that kind of insulates them from significant losses. I also want to touch upon Michael's point about having this facility here, giving the Fed more room to hike. I think that's a really important point. So I would remind everyone of what happened last year with the Bank of England. So last year we had some kind of accident in the gilt market. The Bank of England went in, did some emergency purchases, solved the problem, and then went back to hiking rates. Now, the central banking community is really aware of what's happening now, that they're moving into a very restrictive policy stance that they haven't done in a decade. And the financial sector is opaque, interconnected, and there are some points of fragility. Governor Bowman from the Fed gave a good speech on this the first of this month. And she was saying that, we might have to do some targeted operations somewhere because, maybe somewhere something could break. We have to be able to duct tape that together until we get inflation under control to continue to do our monetary policy stance. And we're seeing that play out in real time. We had, from my perspective, some banks that in California, not well managed, they went bust. So are we really just going to cut rates and do QE when we still have inflation so high? No, we can address this in a targeted way. We can have this bank lending facility, which, as Randy mentioned, is just unprecedented and totally out of character for our central bank. Anyone who knows anything about central banking knows you got to lend against good collateral, punitive rates, and against solvent borrowers. There's nothing like that in this bank lending facility here. But it does allow this problem to be resolved in a targeted way. And if the Fed chooses, they can continue to hike without worrying that these unrealized losses will cause additional trouble to the banking sector.
You mind if I hop in here real quick? Joseph, I couldn't agree more. I think this is what people miss. People broadly think of Fed stimulus or balance sheet as everything is created equal, right? Like no matter what kind of facility the Fed uses, like you just add them all up and do like net liquidity. The reality is not all liquidity is created equal. If I go sell way out of the money puts or protect the tail, it's not the same thing as buying stock, right? What do I mean by that? Just because they're taking the tail off the market, the extreme tail, by deleveraging kind of some of the most speculative risks out there in the market, namely tech and the problem with duration that comes with increasing interest rates. That doesn't mean the market should rally hard. Yes, there's a delta component to selling that proverbial put. But what they're really doing is they're taking off that tail and they're allowing themselves to, as you mentioned, raise interest rates more if they need to without being scared that the whole system will fall apart. And I think that's an important distinction. That's not, just because they went and backstopped all of these banks doesn't mean they're giving a green light to beta. Actually, quite the contrary to your point, I think they're opening up the ability to continue down the path which they are walking down currently.
Thank you. So, Randy, I want to get your comments, but I also want to add a little bit of back framing to it. You said in creating a liquidity crunch, which is deflationary, that that's exactly why they created the very generous BTFP for liquidity, and they want more time to keep rates up to bring inflation down. NIM will also, NIM will be slow to compress too much. Banks are adding prevailing rate loans as well. The Fed needs time. Banks need time. So, Randy, I would love your thoughts here on what the speakers have said so far.
Well, so, you know, for, respectfully, for, you know, take the Fed for its word. In my time in this since 1988, they raise rates on their own terms and the markets make them cut rates. Something breaks or the market goes against them, and they're forced down. I mean, this is the whole idea of Greenspan's conundrum. He didn't understand it because the bond market understood, I know where you're going, I know what you're going to do, and it's coming, and you're going to have to reverse course. And this is what we do this every single time. Why, you know, I understand there's an inflation issue here, but my problem is, like, you've already raised 450. Why not give it some time? But that's like the adult in the room would say, look, we've done a lot. We know we're creating some pain. We're going to try to give you some, a little bit of help to try to avoid some catastrophes. But you know what? That's what I think you should do today. And he won't. I think with Fed funds futures at 80%, which I actually think is oddly low, I think he's going to cut 25. He has to. But to me, come on, say, look, we've done so much already. We're starting to see signs and that's of, you know, inflation coming down. And point out what the New York Fed has been setting out. I've seen them making statements about, you know, month over month inflation's coming down in this category. The BLS put some inflation's way down. And so he could go up and say those things and say, look, we've done so much so fast. We know there's some stress. So we're going to sit and we're just going to watch this thing for a little bit, but we're still committed to making sure that comes down. So I'm not saying we're not going to raise rates again. And I'm not saying I'm going to cut, but at least pause, man. And, you know, Joseph, you make a great point about all the other categories. You got apartments, you got industrial, you've got retail, you know, all that CRE lending. Office is a standout, but let me just tell you, in all those categories, all that lending's competitive, guys. And the way that those loans were to get the business, you know, in the last 5 years, you know, it's pretty tight on the cash flow. So when you take your refinancing rate up 150, 200 basis points, that's a problem, okay? That right there is going to hurt the valuation of that property immediately because, you know, if they haven't been able to keep up, you know, raising rates and raising rentals and all that, it's going to have an effect on those valuations. And that's coming. It's going to come. Now, is it going to crush banks? No, but it's going to continue to compress net interest margin, and it's going to continue to cause, you know, I think some banks some problems, especially the ones who are, you know, high loan to value and a concentration in CRE. And there's some names out there that are really concentrated in, you know, something like construction lending and things like that. So, yeah, they always use their words. They're always confident until they get punched in the face. And then they're like, oh yeah, okay, well, we didn't see that coming. And, you know, I mean, that's what I'm trying to say is, you know, look out for these small little signs, you know, and, you know, I think Bob or somebody mentioned, you know, the 0.2% default on commercial or whatever. Well, you know, I'm feeling really good. You know, when I jump out of a building at 20 floors, I'm okay for 99% of the ride. And then bam, I'm dead. So, I don't need to see the pain right now. I'm trying to tell everybody it's coming, man. And if they raise rates more, it's only going to get worse.
So real quick, I see your hands, Michael and Jem, but I want to pivot back to something that Bob brought up for Jem here. So Bob, so Jem, we're not jumping out of buildings, right? Not quite. Bob brought up a point regarding the risks of regional banks. On TD Ameritrade, you said that the banks that they wanted out were tech and crypto, and they wanted to get the froth out, the speculation. Jem, what are your thoughts regarding the risks in the banking system? And then after that, I have a few questions for Bob and Joseph regarding the FDIC, and then I want to get to Michael's comments as well.
Yeah, the point there was essentially that, you know, the Fed wants, look, again, they, you know, this is kind of, we'll address some of Randy's points, you know, which I don't exactly agree with. The Fed wants to pause. They would love to pause. They aren't sure of the path. There's a lot of different, you know, components within the Fed, you know, saying, hey, look, there's a lag here. We need to stop and see. The problem is the second the market got a whiff of a coming pause, it priced in a pivot and we got a 20% rally off the bottom, right? And then what happened? Everything following was hot CPI, continued very hot employment numbers. There is a reflexive effect to what they do. They are not operating in a world where what they do doesn't ultimately, you know, or what they say doesn't ultimately affect the outcome. So they've been trying to pause for some time, but they can't, and they're being forced into kind of talking down markets, and markets aren't listening because markets don't listen. Markets ultimately, you know, are going to force the Fed's hand. They're reflexive. So I think that's very important. That said, the Fed, you know, how does the Fed take out some of that speculation from the market, right? They have to do it where, you know, they have to try and do it where the speculation is the greatest. And at the same time, I think, you know, they want to take off the tail at the same time. So, you know, the
let me just, if you don't mind, because I think conversational helps here a little bit, but it's happening, man. All my clients are hunkering down. I mean, they really are. They're all going, you know, I asked them, I put out do you plan to grow? Do you plan to stay the same, or do you plan to shrink? And it was between kind of shrink in a sort of a have to way and at least stay stable. Very few said they plan to grow. So it's happening. I mean,
Randy, unemployment is 3.6%. It's the lowest ever. We're adding jobs, not decreasing, right? Like, just go look at the numbers. It's not like you can say it's happening based on talking to XYZ client. That's not what's happening based on the numbers. The Fed would like to pause. They would like to do what you're saying. They would like to stop and like take a breath. 5%, 4.5% is a lot. The problem is the numbers are not supporting their case. They are having a problem. Michael's point, like the Fed pretty publicly came out, Powell was basically talking about how he does want interest, you know, unemployment at 4.6%, not 3.6. He does want 2 million jobs off the table. Like he's saying that, like, it's just not happening. The opposite is happening. And until it does happen, they can't pause. So, I mean, it's not happening yet. That's the problem.
All right, so real quick, Bob, let's kick it to you. Then I've got questions for Joseph on the FDIC, and then I'm going to spin back to Michael for more comments. So, Bob, go ahead.
Yeah, I think one of the important things that I've been highlighting as we've sort of turned our attention and focus to the banking system and its provision of credit is that if you look at the timely data, what you see is actually that banks really starting mid last year and through the most recent period had already meaningfully slowed the magnitude of credit creation that they were providing into the economy, and, you know, close to essentially zero over the course of the last few months. And so I think there's been a lot of focus on, will small banks cut back? Will large banks cut back as a function of what's going on here? The answer is small banks and large banks have cut back. Now, that's a really important thing to think about, because when you're thinking about what the credit supply is relative to the aggregate economic activity, what we see is that growth continues to be running at 2 to 3%, even though credit is has slowed and is running at zero. Now, how can that happen? How can there be such a difference? And I think that really highlights the core dynamic happening in the cycle, which is very different from every cycle that we've experienced in our lifetimes, which is that what we're seeing is a wage and income driven cycle. And that is a really important thing, because what that means is that, yeah, the small banks are going to be just kind of plod along and not do much. The big banks are going to plod along and not do much, but that is not going to solve the inflation problem. Right. The way that we solve the inflation problem is by slowing income growth. And the way that we slow income growth is by loosening the labor markets. And we haven't made much progress yet. Right? Look at the Atlanta Fed wage tracker. You know, one of the best timely reads on things. Nothing's changed in the last 6 or 12 months. We have a long way to go on that. And I know that the Fed sees that. The question is, are they going to do something about it? Or are they going to get skittish given a little bit of stress in the system?
So thank you. Now, Michael, I'm going to come to you in just a moment, but I want to hear Jem's response to those responses, as it were. And then I've got some FDIC questions for Joseph, and then I want to hear your thoughts, Michael. So Jem, first, any response here?
Yeah, I mean, look, at the end of the day, I couldn't agree more. We're in a demand side economy. This is not the last 40 years. Credit creation growing from the business side. This is labor, pricing power, onshoring, protectionist, different growth, right? We have, this is a completely different model. It's fueled by fiscal. It continues to be front and center. Labor pricing, labor power is the story, and it's going to be the story. And until you deal with getting that kind of labor component down, and it's not just percentage of employed, it's wage growth on the bottom. People, you know, the velocity of this money is one, and it's just a completely different market economy than the last 40 years. And I think people are having a hard time adjusting to that reality. It's not about asset expansion. It's about, people on the bottom actually having more savings.
All right. So thank you all for all of your comments there. I want to spin over to FDIC here, and we'll start with Joseph, and then Michael, I'm going to spin to you to get your comments there as well. But first, Joseph, you've said, quote, "We should massively raise FDIC insurance now. The level of deposits in the system is in part due to monetary policy. QE increased bank deposits by trillions, not to mention inflation is high." So, Joseph, why is it important to do so, and what is the right amount to raise to?
Yeah, well, actually, first I'll make a few points in response to what was just said. I totally agree with Jem that the Fed really does want to pause and so forth. Like, I remember in the January FOMC, Powell was quite adamant in disinflation, and that turned out to be incorrect. And so he kind of had to do a 180 after in response to data. And like Randy and Bob have suggesting, we do see bank credit creation slowing. So it does seem to work. But one thing I'd highlight about the US, though, is that we have very strong capital markets. And so a lot of financing, well, if you're getting a home mortgage, for example, about half that, 50% of mortgages are financed in the capital markets. And so when you see treasury yields declining and so forth, even if the banks are tightening up, you're actually going to be facing lower borrowing rates, and not to mention fiscal spending, as Jim mentioned. Okay,
wait, I'm sorry, it's Randy. I think it's like 80% of the mortgages in the United States are like 300 basis points out of the money. So, just refis are dead, and that means it's going to slow that whole process. So I think any kind of inflation coming out of the housing market, I think it's dead for a long time. Just my two cents on that.
What I do note, though, that is that when mortgage rates suddenly crept from 7% to, let's say, 6% in January, it seemed like things were reaccelerating. So we'll see as things go on.
Well, that's a good point. You're right on that. You're absolutely right.
About the FDIC insurance, I think, so like Randy also mentioned earlier, part of the reason that we have Silicon Valley Bank and all these guys flush with deposits is because of quantitative easing. When the Fed expands its balance sheet, when it goes and does QE, it prints a lot of money, and someone at the end of the day has to hold that money. Now, to be clear, banks have a lot of ways to manage their balance sheet. They can push these deposits away and make them go into money funds and the reverse repo facility. But overall, though, not everyone does that. And so if you have the level of deposits in the system rise, more and more people are going to be above the $250,000 FDIC insurance limit. So in a sense, the Fed has a role in creating more uninsured deposits, making it more prone to panics in the banking sector. So that's one point. The other point is, of course, we totally bent the rules to help these VC guys in Silicon Valley. And it would only be fair if we would treat everyone equally and fully insure deposits, and it would immediately end any banking panic that stems from the fear of insolvency in banks. So for something like that to happen, it can't be done by Treasury or the executive unilaterally. It has to be done through an act of Congress. So that's a very slow process. I imagine that there are ways around this, and the administration has been very creative in finding ways to get through this. So maybe they can find another solution. It's hard to know what the right price, what the right level of FDIC insurance should be. But you know, inflation is pretty high. So if we set the FDIC insurance at $250,000 a decade ago, maybe it should be higher. Maybe at least we should adjust it for inflation. It seems like that would make a lot more sense than just having a fixed number that doesn't change, even though inflation is high and even though the Fed keeps pumping the system with more deposits.
All right, real quick, we've got about 3 minutes before the decision is out as far as rate hikes. But before we spin into more questioning, Michael, I want to hear your thoughts here and what you're thinking regarding to what people have said so far in the FDIC. Michael.
Actually, I want to go back to a comment that Joseph made earlier about the BOE hiking even after alleviating the gilt crisis. I shared a tweet in the Nest to basically show you how the U.S. is positioned macroeconomically relative to the U.K. and the EU. Now, this again highlights the notion that transmission mechanisms for hiking are very, very uneven across different economies. But you have to ask yourself, if even the UK and the BOE and the ECB are able to continue hiking, given that their GDPs are at the zero bound and they have both higher unemployment than the US with much higher inflation, how is it that the Fed is going to be spooked by a situation where the S&P just rallied 14% off its lows and NASDAQ is off 23% off its lows? I mean, there just doesn't seem to be anything broken, far, far from it. And I also wanted to just point out that, you know, again, this use of rifles, meaning surgical actions, precludes the need for bazookas. And that's one of the reasons why I've been saying that this BTFP, the market seemed to be reading into a BTFD signal, and it's really not. So I just wanted to say that right before the Fed decision here.
Thank you, Michael. While we wait for numbers, does anyone else have any comments on what was said so far?
Well, I would just say that if nothing's breaking, why do we have so many bazookas? You know, and here it comes. I'll let you guys go.
I would say fair point. Does anyone have a retort there? All right.
Yeah,
so
all the numbers coming
up. That's
what we're looking at.
All right. Looks like 25 bips, which I believe was pretty expected at this point. I think initially we had, just not too terribly long ago, before all the banking stuff started, we had projections for 50, and then some projections obviously changed pretty dramatically following what happened with the bank. So it looks like we've got 25 BPS this time around. Does that change, or does that solidify kind of what you folks were thinking so far going into things today? Anybody feel free to chime in.
So I just also note that the dot plot so is unchanged for 2023 and marginally higher for 2024. Compared to the December thing. So that's immediately what I was focusing on.
Basically, the Fed is not moving off of, right? Nothing's changed, and that's kind of the point, right? Everybody that thinks that what just happened here changed things dramatically, in the last several weeks, it's not true. If anything, again, the markets have changed, but the Fed hasn't, and that is a problem for the Fed.
And it seemed the Fed vote was pretty unanimous as well, straight across the board. Randy, do you have any thoughts here?
Not really. I mean, I just see the 10-year yield coming down. I see the BTFB index seems to be continuing. So the, you know, the overnight 1 year index they're using is down about 10 basis points. So that's what I'm going to watch. Yeah. I watch the bond market. I want to see what they're thinking on this.
I said yesterday that, you know, I'm watching the yield curve very closely, as I'm sure everybody here is. But, you know, when that 1 year point started pricing in 75 to 100 basis points of cuts this year, I basically said, look, I actually think that that plateau that we had just a month ago is going to return. And when that returns, look out for risk assets, because I think the market is just going to find itself off sides here.
Thank you, Michael. Bob, do you have any initial thoughts here on the 25 bips hike?
Yeah, I mean, mostly what we expected. Now, I think we're rolling up our sleeves and looking at the dots, which are worth, you know, looking at December 23 median projection 5.1, December 24 median projection 4.1, and then December 25 3.1. So, you know, certainly if you look at this and you think that there's gonna, you know, the Fed is suggesting that a bunch of cuts later in the year are not where we're gonna be, I think is certainly interesting, if I'm seeing this right. Sorry, just processing the dots and the market action.
Yeah, no problem. No problem. Joseph, do you have anything additional here before we move on to more questions as you're looking through the numbers?
You know, I think that was a good point, Randy, made about why we have so many facilities. You know, when I hear that, I interpret it in light with what happened the past weekend. I think the policymakers are just, you know, like we say, they're always fighting the last war, so they're always nervous if something, you know, might break. And what was remarkable to me was how could have been a legitimately big problem, the failure of a G-SIB over the weekend, just kind of went away overnight. So the policymakers are kind of determined to cut off any tail risk in terms of the markets and things like that. So market is always going to assume that the policymakers are very afraid and dovish. So I can understand the market. What's easiest for the market would be to just assume that rates will be cut and asset prices will go higher, since policymakers are afraid of anything bad happened. That cuts off left tail risk and makes the outcomes biased towards higher asset prices.
Well, how about just avoidance of crushing asset prices? I mean, that's kind of what that's what we're seeing clearly in all the banks' portfolios. Is it's not about, well, I guess it is about raising them, but it's not about taking them a higher than where they got them. It's about having some reprieve, you know, that, you know, you've crushed us into these losses and left us kind of naked. And thank you for the program. But by the way, that program is, you know, a bit fraught with some unexpected, you know, stigma in the future. And they're begging people not to think that, but I could just tell you again, most of my banks, you know, are, you know, particularly after TARP and all the issues there, you know, they took in a flood of money because they did not take TARP. And so they look at this program and it's going to get known. And again, that's another thing that people on, you know, Twitter don't understand is, oh, you won't know for 2 years. No, not true. Anybody traded publicly, you have to put that in your 10Qs and 10Ks immediately. So you have to immediately go to people, your shareholders, and say, and your depositors, and say, yes, we took this money. And then the question becomes why, and it becomes difficult. So, yeah, so that's what I'm looking at there.
Thank you, Randy. Jem, I'm curious your initial thoughts and thoughts on the proverbial bazookas. And on, you know, the Fed leaving us naked, does 25 bips continue this de-robbing, Jim?
Yeah, I mean, I want to be clear, like this, you know, watch out for this. If vols come in here a little bit on this number, like this is an opportunity. Just don't take this kind of as, you know, what Powell is going to say here, I think is very important. I think he's going to be pushed back into the fray, unfortunately, given the rally back and, again, the move in yields. We're not the only ones watching the bond market right now. The Fed at the end of the day is providing liquidity, short-dated, and on the tail, while trying to take economic liquidity out of the market, which is more the long end of the curve. The Fed does not want inflation, like speculation to kind of come back into the market and economic kind of growth to be accelerated. So that's my, again, kind of what I've been saying. I do think the positioning, which we have talked about, we're all talking kind of macro here. I'll just kind of say a couple things here. Probably vol, more light last week in particular. I don't think that's a coincidence. We've been talking about this for some time. Everybody out of India and hedges of any real pliable ZBTE stuff, that stuff is not working really well in this environment. And a lot of people who are short Vega to be long Gamma, that is ultimately a trade we haven't seen work in years, decades, in any meaningful way for any meaningful amount of time. That's something I watched very carefully because we saw some very interesting moves in that relationship. And given how bad positioning has gotten and how overweight's gotten, people are talking about the zero DTE, but I don't think people realize what that means in the sense that people are using that exclusively, and that means people aren't positioned against kind of any long-term secular move. So that's something I'd watch. The other thing nobody's talked about is NASDAQ versus Russell. The last week and a half has been fairly historic in terms of that move. Underneath the surface, you're getting some really big moves. There's a macro thesis for why that is, right? Everybody's talking about, this explanation. The reality is all the hedges have duration. That hedge has been completely taken out of the market relative to,
Jem, looks like you're having some breaking up with connection there, Jem. Just for the quick minute here, see if we can wait for that to level off a bit. I'm going to spin to Bob, and then I might want to come back to you, Jem, regarding being short Vega. That's when you started breaking up. But first, Bob, very quick. Should we be believing this initial market reaction, given 25 bips, is still technically a rate hike, and the dot plot hasn't really changed, Bob?
Yeah, I don't. Certainly. The initial moves in terms of the asset markets would suggest easier than expected, certainly in the bond market and tick up in across the equity market. Trading the time between the announcement and the initial statement and the presser would not be where I would be trading. A lot of uncertainty in that. But when you scan across what, the initial take of this is that the Fed is going to be keeping things easy relative to expectations, and that's probably not going to be well received. We'll see what Paul says in a few minutes, but my guess is that that's not the response that they wanted to this set of conditions.
Can I share a big picture mental model with the crowd?
So yeah, please.
So yesterday I retweeted this really interesting and cool graphic of the expectations of Fed funds. And it just showed how, the so-called omniscient bond market and yield curve is equally as clueless as every other asset class. But when you think about, I think of the risk-free rate as the financial linchpin for all things financial, right? So it is tantamount to oscillating the bottommost Jenga block amidst a very wobbly tower. And so when you see these like violent reactions in asset classes across the board, I just want to caution people that I think you're seeing the tip of the whip, if you will. If the bottommost Jenga block is that hard to forecast and read, imagine trying to read a lot of signal content into moves in all of the derivative asset classes.
Couldn't agree more, Michael.
Thank you for that, Mike.
Great metaphor now, but great metaphor. The reality is the biggest counter trend moves are markets. This is not a healthy move. We've seen the underlying moves are speaking to kind of this, right? This market that's kind of very unstable and has a lot of potential energy in it. And that is dangerous. That is a low-critic market and exactly what a time you want to be cautious.
Yeah, I guess part of what's being focused on here is at least in the statement, the Fed has announced or is acknowledging that the effects of the banking system dynamics are uncertain. And so, you know, that I guess it's the same, you know, in many ways, it's just the same thing over and over again that we've seen from the last couple of these meetings, which is, you know, there's all. And indicative, as you just said, of people trying, it's like there's so much, there is a ton of liquidity in the system. There's still a lot of risk-taking desires in the system. The Fed has not broken that. And so what we see is, you know, it almost looks like folks are looking for a reason why they should be a buyer of stocks and bonds. And they're looking for that as much as they can into the presser and into any of the indications here. And, you know, they've focused on that.
Thank you. Now, Joseph, do you have any comments here on believing the market or the whiplash of tail risks and playing Jenga?
I think those are all great comments. I really am waiting to see what Chair Powell says in his press conference. As was noted, it seems like so. Before all this excitement happened the past couple of weeks, the expectation, of course, was 50 basis points and a higher dot plot. Now we get 25 and we have a dot plot. That's the same for 2023, but ever so slightly higher for next year. So basically, as Bob mentioned, there's no change. And so I think what it really come down to is just how Chair Powell characterizes what happened the past couple of weeks and how he thinks that it will influence his path of policy. I think, as many people on Twitter has commented, that you know, there's a whole lot of uncertainty, so it might not be super useful. But I think it's really important to understand what how he perceives this. And you know, the market is always thinking that the Fed is going to cut rates. That's what the market thinks, that the future looks like the past. And over the past 10 years, we've been in a regime where the Fed likes to cut rates. The market has been very wrong for the past year or so, and I still think they are, but I want to see what Chair Powell says.
So, Randy, how do you think the uncertainties will play out in banking given the 25 BPS hike? And, Randy, do you still think the Fed will cut rates soon? And then I'll kick over to comments from anybody else who wants to chime in as well. But first, Randy.
Yeah, I don't think the 25 basis points means, you know, anything too stressful for my banks. I think they're going to, you know, they're going to continue to see deposit decay, and they're going to have to, you know, do more borrowings. That's going to compress NIM. So, but they expected that. I still think that, you know, look, how many times have we, over the years, have we seen, you know, stocks go limit down and the Fed does something? I mean, you know, they're going to protect the system. And if something breaks, everything reverses. And we just saw something break, and it isn't just about Silicon Valley, because I think that's a whole nother thing going on there. I don't think that's just community bank, and I think we'll find that out later. But, you know, the fact is it showed an exposure, and the Fed came up with a whole new brand program over the weekend. I mean, if that's not alarming, I don't know what else could possibly, you know, concern people. Particularly, everybody seems very positive that everything's okay and they can keep raising rates to 6%. I just don't see that happening. I think the stress is coming, and it's going to be one of those things that, okay, well, you know, we got to undo this. And I want to make one comment before, you know, I mentioned a certain person calls this dog named NVIDIA, and I know you don't want me to do that, but financial media, and then you got somebody, which I think I can mention, Richard Fisher was out, you know, I think a few days ago, claiming that banks did something wrong. And I think that's why I'm here. And maybe we'll have to do it another time to talk about that more in depth. But that's the message I'm trying to get to everybody and to people on Twitter. You know, maybe there's a bank here that, sure there is, okay? But on the whole, you have to understand banks are really, really good. They're really, really strong. And they were forced into certain situations. So I wish those guys would stop saying these bad bankers, these greedy bankers, they bought bad bonds. It's just not freaking true. And that's the main message I want to get to everybody here.
Thank you, Randy. Anybody else have any other comments? We've got about 13 minutes before the J Pal presser, but any other comments? Would love to hear them.
I'll jump in, just kind of fill some air here. I didn't get to finish. I think I broke up there before, but two core major changes in positioning. One, I mentioned Gamma versus Vega. The world is no longer hedged on the kind of longer end of the distribution. If anything, there is short Vega funding long Gamma. What do I mean by that? If people on here are not kind of option nerds, we're playing short dated hedges, very short dated hedges, have replaced all and any structural long-term hedges. And if anything, people are funding those with Vega, because Vega, quite frankly, hasn't worked for more than a week or so at a time over what's, you know, essentially 14 years. Minus the Volpocalypse, which was a short-term blip, really, really nothing to speak of. So that world, it didn't work last year. Vol got crushed if you were in that stuff. Mass exodus last year, all into kind of realized vol hedges, which is the short-dated stuff. The net effect of that is short-term Gamma moves are likely to mean revert and not play out. Whereas long-term Vega could really find its way going higher into the next move. I think as we've seen that, you saw some very interesting counter trend moves in another area too, which I think is very important. We've both seen commodities as well as the Russell, small cap value really kind of liquidate relative to duration and tech. That's the other big hallmark of positioning. The world went from speculating on calls into the last rally to now speculating on puts. Put call ratios went through the roof in tech. Everywhere else, they've been under hedge. So what do you find? What happens as you go into March OPEX last week? Massive outperformance of tech, and the squeeze of that positioning accelerates. That's what we saw. We've been talking about that for weeks leading into that. Not a surprise that we're seeing this counter trend move there. Those two hallmarks are big positioning. Once they start breaking, it's something to be very cognizant of, and understand that positioning is big enough where it can drive in new trends.
Perfect. Thank you, Jem. So go ahead.
I just wanted to say that I think the potential rug pull for risk isn't so much how high the terminal rate gets, it's how long it stays there. And I expect I expect Jay Powell to emphasize higher for longer in this speech. We'll see what happens.
And on that note, we've got about 10 minutes before the presser. So what I want to do here is, for everybody listening, we're going to stream the audio of J Pal's presser here on this same space. And we'll also have the video and live chat on the Unusual Twitch. That is twitch.tv/unusualwhales for the video and chat. But before we do that, I want to get closing thoughts from each of our panelists here. And also, please feel free to plug anything you're working on or anything you've got coming out. We'll go right down the line here, just a minute or two each. Closing thoughts, anything you're working on that we can plug here for you today. Let's start with Joseph. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here, and I always learn from our panelists here.
So I agree with Michael. I think that Chair Powell's job is going to have to be able to send that higher for longer message, because monetary policy isn't just toggling the overnight rate. It's also what how the market perceives the path of policy to be. If the market is really convinced that the Fed is just going to cut rates in a few months and, you know, we'll go back to the way it was, then, you know, borrowing rates are going to come down. A lot of people are going to have lower borrowing costs, and there's a potential there for inflation to reaccelerate. So it's a really, really hard message to send to the market, especially since the Fed over the past decade has really shown an inclination to pivot like they did in early 2019. So I write and blog about the markets. If you want to hear more about my thoughts, I have a website, fedguy.com. If you're interested in learning about markets, I have a book called Central Banking 101, bestseller on Amazon, and also I have online courses. It's a 10 set of 10 courses. The first one is free if you click the free preview. You can find that at fedguy.com as well. Thanks so much.
And I must say that book, one of the better reads that anybody can tune into regarding these topics. So thank you as always for coming, Joseph. Michael, any closing thoughts? Anything you want to plug here before we get into the J Powell presser?
Yeah, thank you for having me as always. My closing thoughts are that, look, this the risk on, risk off is driven by a market that's confused between sort of what I call the market is still in this bad equals good matrix, when the real at some point the real economy will be bad as bad. I want to reiterate that I think these ring-fenced actions are not quite QE. Therefore, BTFP does not equal BTFD when it comes to risk assets, in my opinion. Let's see, what am I working on? I guess the only thing that's really new is this Substack. I ever since my Twitter suspension, I've been putting longer form content on Substack, and I started doing like a weekly recap on urbancowboy.substack.com. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much, Michael. I always love having your input here. Really good back and forth banter today. Bob, anything you want to say before we get to J-Pow? Anything you want to plug?
Thanks for having me. I love these conversations and a live, nothing better than a sort of lively and spirited back and forth about what's going on. For those of you who are interested in what I'm up to, you can check out unlimitedfunds.com, where I've got a blog, and also there's a link to the HFND ETF, which we run. So check that out to see if it's right for your portfolio. And then also, you know, check me out on Twitter. I tweet even when there aren't banking crises afoot about what's going on in macro and things like that. So love to see folks out there.
Definitely do that, folks. And just kind of as a blanket statement, you should be following all of our panelists today. Really brilliant minds in these macroeconomic topics. Perfect follows if you're trying to stay up to date on what's happening and kind of the reasoning behind it. So I can't stress enough that everybody that's been on this panel so far, definitely worthy of a follow. Maybe even that nice little notification button. Hell. All right, Jem, do you have any closing thoughts here about what we've discussed so far today? And of course, anything you want to plug?
Yeah, so a couple things were mentioned here, which I think are very important to kind of highlight. The higher the Fed has gone here on Fed funds, the more we're starting to see what we have always expected, which is, you know, there's a hollowing out, call it the jiggling of that little Jenga piece, call it kind of, hollowing out of like this sound, kind of that Fed funds results of the market.
Looks like we're getting some connection issues there again, Jim. Sorry about that, and sorry, folks. Sorry. Jim always has really good to say. Yeah, pretty choppy here, Jim. But just yeah, it's still pretty bad. But for Jim, folks, KaiVolatility.com. Check that out. Always tons of really great information there. And Jim is a recurring guest in our spaces and always has really good insight, especially when it comes to volatility. So thank you as always for coming, Jim. Last but not least, Randy, do you have any closing thoughts here on what any panelists have said and anything you could apply?
I'll make it quick. And you have given me permission to say this, so everybody knows. Joseph and I will be on with Jack Farley at Forward Guidance tomorrow. I'm not exactly sure what time. I think around 11 a.m. Eastern, but it will air tomorrow. And I think that's going to be a lot of fun. I'm a huge fan of Joseph. I don't know how I found him, but, you know, once I saw his 5 years New York Fed desk, I'm like, oh, I got to talk to this guy. And I highly recommend his book, as well as Danielle DiMartino Booth's. I think they're both a good look into the inner workings of the Fed. And what I particularly liked about what Joseph wrote about, what I got, one of the main things I got from his book is I always knew there was coordination between central banks. I didn't know to what level. His description of how other central bank traders will literally train on the New York desk before they're sent off into overseas, you know, other central banks, I thought was fascinating. And so that's caused me to really pay attention to what other central banks say, because I think it is highly more coordinated than I ever realized. Lastly, to blow a little sunshine, I don't have anything to sell other than Jack's thing, which I'm super excited about tomorrow. Hopefully Elon Musk is listening, because this is exactly what makes Twitter awesome. I'm always telling people on Twitter, if you hate it, it's because you're doing something wrong. We have these lovely people that are educated and willing to give us their time. And, you know, and I know, I'm always the pessimist in the crowd. That's what a bond guy does. That's my job. I have to look for what's terrible in life. When I sell these bonds, what's going to kill me? So that's my nature. I love being challenged by all these really lovely people. And I just appreciate all you guys so much. And thanks for letting me be here. Thank you.
And thank you for coming, as always. Like I said, these panels, I always learn so much. It seems like everybody learns a lot from each other. And even when there's dissonance, everything's always so respectful. People, even when they don't see eye to eye, they're just, you know, here to learn, explain their part. And I mean, hey, that's the whole point of these, right? So people can learn. So thank you all for coming. We've got the J-Pal Presser starting in about a minute. So if you are not following our panelists today, please get on that. You're going to learn a lot from these folks. They're, you know, tweeting more or less every day. We'll be streaming the audio for the Presser right here on this space, as well as on the Unusual Whales Twitch with live chat at twitch.tv/unusualwhales. If you came in late and missed anything during this space, don't worry about it. It was recorded, and we will be releasing it as an Unusual Whales podcast on Spotify, Apple, and YouTube. So if you missed anything, don't sweat it. You didn't miss anything. Thanks again, everybody, for coming. Just a minute here. We'll get the audio to the Presser going, and then we'll send y'all on your way.